Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people to talk about God, the Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects, as you will find out later in Season 3. I would like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you who are joining me for this new season of Context Matters. And my deepest thanks go to my Patreon team with people like Kathy and Scott Parker, because due to this team, this podcast is entering its third season, and this could not happen without them. So thank you. This week, I continue my conversation with Dr. Sandy Richter, who is the Robert H. Gundry Chair of Biblical Studies at Westmont College. We continue to discuss her book, Stewards of Eden, what Scripture says about the environment and why it matters. At the end of last week's episode, Dr. Richter and I were talking about the difference between belonging to the land versus owning the land, or considering nature as a commodity that is consumed. At one point, she mentioned the law code of Hammurabi, so I thought we should go back and discuss the ways in which comparing the Israelite law code with other ancient Near Eastern law codes helps us understand God's perspective on how we can live successfully in the natural world. In Deuteronomy, there are laws about what you can do in war and what you can't do in war. You cannot do massive ecological damage in order to conquer a people group. So let's start here and talk about that. So these laws in Deuteronomy, as we are looking at them often as scholars, we tend to see, you know, is this unique to the ancient world or are they similar to the ancient world? And so these almost environmental terrorism type, don't destroy the land in order to destroy the people. Is that unique in the ancient Near East, or is that the code everyone was living by?
Mm-hmm. And essentially what you're asking me is, were the people of God different?
Right.
Or is this just normative for them?
And it's kind of a, yeah, is God's design different and the way he's wanting his people to live, as opposed to, yeah, was everyone doing that?
And therefore, of course, the modern application, are we called to be different?
Yeah.
And I would say that the people of God in every generation are called to be different. So let me quantify that. The laws in Deuteronomy, and your listeners will be interested to know that sustainable agriculture, sharing with the widow and the orphan, defending the wild creature, taking care of his habitat, environmental terrorism, and even how to care for POWs is all addressed in the Deuteronomic law code. It puts us to shame. We've got several thousand years on these people, and they've already got it in print. So narrowing in on environmental terrorism, the case study I use in my book is something called Operation Ranch Hand. And some of your listeners will recognize this. This was the Agent Orange assault that we made use of in our support of South Vietnam in the Vietnamese Civil War. So the Vietnam War. And it was environmental terrorism. We used a chemical composition to wipe out their forests and their agricultural land in South Vietnam in order to unseat the Viet Cong. And we wound up doing so much damage, not only to our enemies, the Viet Cong, but to our allies, the South Vietnamese, and to our own veterans who are still dealing with the diseases and the trauma that resulted from our environmental terrorism. Okay, so that's the case study. What do we see when we look at the book of Deuteronomy? There's this lovely little law that says, when you besiege a city, which is a standard form of ancient Near Eastern warfare, so you've surrounded the city, you're trying to cut off their food supply, their water supply, and you're trying to break them into surrender because they're behind their fortified walls, your army's on the outside. So in cutting them off from their supplies, you're trying to get a surrender. And if that doesn't work, you're also going to keep assaulting the walls with your army, your archers, and with siege ramps. So your siege ramp will go up to the top of their wall, and therefore your army will be able to get inside the city. Okay, so there's this lovely little law in Deuteronomy that says, when you besiege a city and you need wood, lumber, in order to build your siege ramps, you are not allowed to cut down the trees that produce food. So as you and I both know, there are all sorts of trees that produce food in Israel, nuts and fruits and olives and date palms and all that sort of thing. Okay, so the Israelites are being told, you have to live with restraint, which is a word you've used a couple of times. You can take down some trees, but you can't take down all the trees. And you can't take down the trees that you need in the next generation, because it takes 20 years to get a date palm grove to the place where it produces. It takes 20 more years to get an olive yard to the place where it produces. So don't be stupid. Don't wipe out the future productivity of the land for the sake of winning a battle. Okay, so that law is in Deuteronomy, 1200 BC. Let's go for an early date here. What are the Assyrians doing? So the Assyrians are the big empire that surrounds Israel's monarchic age. Well, the Assyrians, as I demonstrate in the book, are notorious for scorched earth policies. They're notorious for environmental terrorism. So for them, when they besiege a city, even if they know they're going to lose, like they can't get past the walls of Megiddo, they're going to go all around the agricultural land and take down, burn, decimate all of the olive yards, the date palm orchards, et cetera, so that when those farmers finally emerge from the safety of their besieged city, they will have nothing to sustain them. We also have a great deal of archaeological data that in these sieges, they actually change the topography of the land, which, of course, is going to result in water issues, mudslide issues, flooding issues, et cetera. And I would say that that is the essence of environmental terrorism, that if I can't defeat the humans, or if I need assistance defeating the humans, I can do it by destroying their land. So Hittites, Egyptians, especially the Assyrians, everyone around Israel is practicing environmental terrorism. They are literally sowing fields with salt to raise the salinity of the soil and therefore to render the agricultural soil inhabitable for future agriculture. And Deuteronomy forbids Israel from doing it. So yes, Israel is being called to be unique. And in that, of course, they are putting themselves at military risk from just the perspective of international policy, because they're not fighting fire with fire. And as a result, they might lose that battle. And Yahweh is calling on them, have confidence in me that I'm going to take care of you and leave the land healthy so that it can support the next generation.
Right. There's a couple of those laws in Deuteronomy that blow my mind, but one of them, and again, just because they were living on the edge of life and death, you know, the land is kind of right on that knife edge, and they're living there in terms of having enough, not lacking anything. And there is, for this marginal landscape, there is a law that when you are grinding grain, don't muzzle the ox. It is astonishing to me, especially when you pull in all the scholarship that's been done about how much an ox will eat while it is working. You think, don't you? I mean, I would think as a farmer, I would want as many kernels of grain as possible, because one harvest has to last me the whole rest of the year, right? There's no run out to Costco to top up, right? It is. And if my ox in the moment is consuming that much grain, it's just one of those laws that blows my mind, as I think that had to be so, the type of self-restraint God is calling his people to is maybe one that we don't fully register the extent of.
Yes. And all of these laws that, you know, allow the ox to eat to his heart's desire during the harvest, of not going over your olive tree again, not going over your vineyard again, not going over your barley field again. All of these are in the context of a subsistence economy and people we know were going hungry. And there are very few people listening to your podcast who are going hungry because they honestly can't afford to eat. Now, I have gone hungry a few times, and it is a pretty miserable place to be. The Israelites were dealing with this on a daily basis. And yet in the midst of that personal economic need, God is still requiring them to care for the land, to care for the creatures that serve them, and to care for the wild animal. And he's speaking these laws into their fierce economic need. And they're obeying, we hope and pray. And yet here we are as Americans who have enough food in our pantries to last a month if required right now without Costco, right? And we ignore those laws because they're expensive. Because a dozen eggs produced by free-range, humanely raised, organically fed chickens costs $1.50 more than ones coming out of battery cages, hyped up on fertility drugs, and abused throughout their short lives. So for $1.50, we will ignore the law. Whereas for the Israelite, it was whether or not they could put food on their table for their children during the hungry season.
In a lot of scholarly material about Christianity and environmentalism, the name Lynn White comes up. So I asked Dr. Richter to explain his role in the conversation of the Bible and the natural world.
My knowledge of Lynn White is he was neither involved in the faith community nor really speaking to the faith community. I think he was speaking to the academy about the faith community. And White does not go after the church. He goes after Christianity. And like so many conversations we're having right now, and I'm an undergraduate professor, and the issue of racial reconciliation is so hot on our campus right now. Environmentalism and racial reconciliation have a lot in common when it comes to the way the church has approached them, in that the church hasn't approached them, or the church has failed in its responsibility. But this is what I say to my students, and I would say the same thing about environmentalism. The church has failed, but that doesn't mean Christianity has failed. And Lynn White declares that the Judeo-Christian ethic has done more damage to environmental stewardship than any other force in history. And I disagree with him. Right now, if you were to check in with the United Nations and ask which country on this planet is having the most detrimental impact on the health of this planet, the answer without hesitation would be China. Unprecedented environmental impact. Well, the Judeo-Christian ethic has not shaped China's economy, its ethics, or its posture toward the environment. The next country that would fall in line would be India. And once again, the Judeo-Christian ethic has had very little influence there. So one, I don't actually know if I say this in Stewards, I say it in another article I've written. I don't think any religion on this planet has dibs on having abused the planet more. I think the fallenness, the greed, the self-serving, commodity-oriented mind of humanity is the problem. And this is why I think redemption should speak to this problem. It doesn't take 10 seconds to get a redeemed believer to recognize the impact of the fall on human relationships, on government, on the abuse of the poor, on the silencing and abuse of the marginalized. And we stand up for these issues. The church has built more hospitals and orphanages than any other organization on this planet. We recognize that redemption speaks into those relationships. What we don't recognize is that redemption should speak into our relationship with the planet as well. And not because the planet is a widow or an orphan, right? I'm not raising its rights to the level of a sentient creature the way many people would. What I'm saying is that Christians are people under authority. We live under the authority of the Almighty. And we define good by the character of the Almighty. And the Almighty has said, this stuff is mine. And he says it over and over again throughout the law code. It's mine. This land is mine. These animals are mine. These people are mine. You take care of them because I told you so. And this land has got to be fruitful and productive for the next generation of my people. So don't mess with it. And in fact, I compare it to landlord and renter, which college students can really tag into. If you strip the plaster off the walls, you're losing your security deposit. Israel stripped the plaster off the walls and they were sent into exile. And the book of Leviticus actually says that Yahweh states, I am taking back the Sabbaths. You did not let the land lie fallow. I'm going to give it 70 years of fallow. That's our God who cares about sustainable agriculture right there.
Yeah. It's interesting because in your book, you also tie in taking that biblical concept, that idea, and saying, if we look at which animals have become extinct now, it's because we're destroying their habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to read some of the stats and some of the ways you pull together some of that information to say, we can't just sit back and worry about the panda bear going extinct. We need to pay attention to the environment needed to support those creatures because yeah. God cares, because those creatures matter, because it yeah. creates the whole design that we're supposed to be in.
And that's what I circle back to in the book over and over again is, okay, there are 1,000 voices out there yelling at us about climate change, environmental sustainability, panda bears, polar bears, you know, you name it. But the voice that every Christian wants to hear is the voice of the Bible, right? The argument I make for environmental stewardship is I'm speaking specifically to the church. I mean, you are my target audience. And in many ways, my goal is to awaken the sleeping giants, because the church is a very powerful voice in society. And the character that every Christian at least has committed themselves to imitate is the character of our God. So let's investigate our rule of faith and practice from Genesis to the New Jerusalem and ask the question, is there environmental concern in here? And especially when we deal with Israel, and back to Deuteronomy, because we have to go back to Deuteronomy.
We have to. Everything goes back to Deuteronomy.
We've got law codes. We've got law codes of a landed people. They're living in a particular ecosphere. And we have law codes that start being recorded in the Iron Age. I mean, we can push this back to 1200 BC. And the God of the Bible is actually expressing concern about the wild creature, about sustainable agriculture. He forbids environmental terrorism. He cares about humane animal husbandry, making sure that livestock are cared for. This is the God we serve. So why are we ignoring those issues if he isn't?
There is something about the developed world now and the industrialized age that we live in that removes us so far from, well, we could say the supply chain, but we could say mm-hmm. maybe even just the original context, right? Those animals. When I go to Trader Joe's and I'm looking at the egg section, I'm so far removed from thinking of the chicken as an actual animal, mm-hmm. which is different than, I know you have chickens and we have chickens out in our backyard too. It's so different than going out to where they are, smelling the smells, knowing if their cage needs to be cleaned out, and then mm-hmm. reaching my hand into to grab the eggs. Yeah. In that case, I'm so fully aware that those chickens gave me that egg.
Yes.
So how do we get in this industrialized age, how do we start paying attention to the supply chain or to the animal?
And it is a challenge, and it's a challenge for many, many reasons, not the least of which the industries, like, honestly, they are intentionally keeping us ignorant. It is illegal in this country right now to film a slaughter plant. I tell a story in the book of a young woman on the side of a highway who pulled out her cell phone and clicked film. She's standing on public land. It's a slaughter plant across the street. And within just a few minutes, there are 7 squad cars there to arrest her for a slaughter plant. It's illegal to take pictures of the inside of any slaughter plant, the outside or inside. Most of the industrial farms are staffed almost exclusively by immigrants, either very new immigrants or illegal immigrants, because they won't speak up. There's as much as 100% turnover in these factories that used to be farms. So the average American has no idea where their meat and milk and eggs are coming from. They believe the pictures they see on the side of the milk carton. But reality is that at this point in time, 95% of all meat that reaches your Walmart, your Albertsons, your Kroger, wherever it is you do your food shopping, has been raised on an industrial farm, which means mass confinement, abusive confinement. It means that these animals have been genetically altered to come to maturity in half the time that the chickens and pigs that our parents ate came to maturity. The conditions they live under are horrific. If the average American knew this stuff, we would speak up. And that's why this book has got case study after case study in it, because the information is, it is nauseating. It's nauseating. And the Europeans, they've outlawed most of the practices that are normative in our industrial agriculture. And therefore, if you've been to Europe lately, you pay more for your food. Yeah, you do. Because the animals are treated in a humane fashion, and farmers, here's the other victim of industrial farming, real farmers who actually know their animals live a middle income. Whereas in the States, farmers are dropping like flies and the suicide rates are off the charts. Wisconsin, you can't find a dairy farm anymore. The statistics are staggering. It's horrible. We know very little about it because that's where the industries want us.
As you were writing this book, so you have, you're seeing very clearly the biblical stance that, as you said, is on basically every page. It is addressed by every type of author, the prophets, the writers, everyone. And as you're kind of thinking and writing this book and bringing in modern research, where did you find your hope? You're seeing this dichotomy of how far away we are from the biblical text.
Where did I find hope?
Yeah, where were the moments where you went, okay, but we're doing okay here, or but here is where I see we can go.
Right. Well, I find it interesting that you would ask that question, because when I get to the very end of the book and I offer resources for the responsible Christian, I start off with the issue of hope. Because one of the major players in environmental advocacy starts off the chapter by speaking about their life calling, landing them in a therapist chair because they couldn't deal with the anxiety of this overwhelming failure any longer. Okay, so where do I find hope? I find hope in this question the same place I find hope when I think about orphans and widows and people I care deeply for spinning off into heretical, unorthodox cult views, people I love with my life who don't want to hear the gospel, right? So the hope is that the king is coming. And when he does, he's going to set this right. And he will reclaim his land. He will resurrect his land. He will heal his land. And the New Jerusalem will be the restored Eden. So that would be my overarching hope. But when it comes to my daily practices, like why do I even bother, right? With what I know, and I know too much, why do I bother to recycle? Why do I bother to go through the 6 months of getting solar panels on my roof? Why do I clean up after my chickens? Why am I doing these things? And I approach my posture toward environmental stewardship the way I approach every other issue of sanctification in my life, that this is not going to happen overnight. This is a daily discipline, a long obedience in the same direction, that I am being conformed to the image of Christ. Will I ever manage to rescue every refugee? Do I have the resources to feed or house every orphan? Can I get every foster child who has been dissembled by the system into my home and show them something different? And the answer is no, I don't have the resources to do that. But does that change my responsibility to stand with the opposition? And I think everybody listening to your podcast would say, of course not. No, I cannot take care of every orphan, but dang it, I'm going to sponsor as many as I can. Can I really turn the tide of racial injustice in this country? No, but will I treat the people who are on the margins with respect in my life? Heck yeah, I will. So that is how I approach this. Actually, I was at an ETS meeting, and for your listeners, that's Evangelical Theological Society. And I was giving one of my papers on this topic, and all these lovely young PhDs were, you know, energized by the paper, and they're basically on their feet saying, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? How do we change this? And the old woman in me is saying, you know, guys, we're never actually going to fix this. We're not going to fix this. We're not going to fix it anymore. Then we're going to fix the wave of refugees coming out of Somalia. But does that change the fact that the church stands in the gap and shouts out a different story and models a different story? No. We stand on the wall. and that's how I deal with this.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your work. I am a huge fan. I mean, you know that, but I love this work. I think your other work has been so important and has transformed churches all over the place. I know several people who follow your curriculums, Epic of Eden as a big one, but I feel so deeply in my bones that this is one that the church really, really just needs to ingest and really allow it to become a part of who they are in a way that they haven't done in a long time. And so I really hope everyone buys the book, sits with the book, thinks about the book, allows it to challenge them. And maybe, you know, maybe we can all just take one little step or a couple steps to make incremental changes.
Steps forward.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Thank you so much.
And that's what the last section of the book is about, is okay, how do you take a few steps forward? And, you know, I do not expect all of your listeners to go buy chickens. You know, this
is not for their backyards.
Yeah. But how do we take some steps forward? And as you're touching on, this issue is so important to our neighbors, not just our next door neighbors, but our neighbors halfway across the planet. This is an issue that affects the lives of tens of thousands of people. What a witness it is that the church would take this issue seriously. And what more do we want to be than a witness to a fallen world? So it is my prayer and hope that we'll listen to our rule of faith and praxis, and we will hear the character of our God, and we'll be able to respond.
Thank you so much for taking time this afternoon, for being on the podcast. I love it so much.
It is so much fun to be on Cindy Parker's podcast. I get to be famous. This is very cool. So thank you for the invitation.
As always, it is wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you here at the virtual table. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. If you want to help support the podcast, you can join my Patreon team using the link in the show notes, or you can promote this show on your social media accounts. And make sure you stay tuned in during the next couple weeks when I will let you know how you can win a signed copy of my new book. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created all of the music you hear. I look forward to our conversation next week. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.